Last week, we marked the 50-year anniversary of 2001 A Space Odyssey with a look at how the film was made. Today, we're going to dive into the unique music and sound choices that were made by director Stanley Kubrick. We recently talked to Michael Galope, an assistant professor in the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of Deep Refrains, Music, Philosophy, and the Ineffable. We asked him why the music and sound Kubrick used is so important in understanding this unique film. Well, the music and sound of 2001, maybe more so than for other movies, is really important. Can you talk about why they're such a key part of 2001?
Well, I think 2001 is unusual as a film because so much of the story and a lot of its deep philosophical questions are actually told to us with the music and not with the words. The characters that Kubrick puts in the film, people have remarked they're more or less static or emotionless, and the dialogue they have feels relatively ordinary, sometimes perfunctory and uninteresting.
Hi.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
We haven't seen you up here for a long time.
No. Very nice to see you again.
Did you have a pleasant flight, sir?
Yes, very nice, thanks. I think Mr. Miller of Station Security is supposed to be meeting me.
Oh, well, may I call him for you?
Would you please?
And the drama that there is, principally with Hal in the second half of the film, is very cold and slow. So the film is dominated by these elegant, slow-moving shots. And they're accompanied by music and sometimes other kinds of sound or even silence. But Kubrick gives us a lot of time to think without hearing any words. But exactly what we're supposed to think during all this time remains unclear.
And I understand, I just learned this recently, Kubrick had originally commissioned a score, an original score for the film, then changed his mind at almost literally the last minute about what music to use.
Yeah, that's right. So Kubrick commissioned a score from an established composer, Alex North, that had done the music for Kubrick's Spartacus. Kubrick had in place a selection of classical music recordings that were there sort of as temporary tracks, and he could use just for the purposes of editing, which was a relatively common practice. Kubrick then showed Alex North the edit of the film with this classical music in place, but he ultimately decided to reject this relatively traditional film score that North delivered and decided to stick with the classical music that he was using just as a temporary track.
Now let's talk about some of the ways that Kubrick ultimately did use music and sound design and talk with the famous opening sequence that I think people probably think of when they think of music from 2001.
Right. So this is the iconic opening credit of 2001. We hear the sunrise fanfare from Richard Strauss's tone poem, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which is an orchestra piece based on Friedrich Nietzsche's book of the same name, which had actually just been published a few years earlier in 1891. And so on screen, what do we see? We see the earth slowly rising, and we watch the sun rise symmetrically over the moon. To make of the opening. One place to look that many have looked at is the book that Strauss based this orchestra piece on, Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And this is a book that discusses grand metaphysical themes about human evolution, about human destiny. And Nietzsche's book also contains the famous declaration that God is dead. So we're talking about the destiny of humanity, but in the context of this cold, physical, real universe. So in the opening, we just hear the music. We hear this fanfare, and we haven't read all this philosophy. Even with just the sound and the image, we know something is up. The next time we see this image of a symmetrical aligning of the planets at the beginning of the Stargate sequence, where Jupiter is aligned with its moons, and this mysterious monolith appears horizontally, and then we hear it once more, or we hear the music again at the end, the Zarathustra fanfare returns, Dave, our astronaut on the Odyssey, is mysteriously transformed into this star child. So the film is framed by this fanfare, and it's sort of a grand framing that tells us something vague. This film is philosophical. There's some big philosophical question about man's place in the cosmos that we're being asked. But Kubrick doesn't tell us what to think. He doesn't spell out all the particulars. He lets the audience decide what it all means. And this is one of those examples where, rather than having, say, a voiceover describing what you should think philosophically about the destiny of man, just using the fanfare keeps it open-ended for the audience.
And talk about how Kubrick uses music to represent the aliens in the film.
So this is a very famous choice of Kubrick's. He chose four pieces by the Hungarian avant-garde composer Georg Ligeti. And this music frequently, I think, always appears with the monoliths. And it's not easy to say what this music is doing, other than to say it indicates probably some kind of terrifying alien presence. The monoliths are always, I think, accompanied by Ligeti. We know that they're linked somehow. So in this sequence where they're going to discover the monolith on the moon, the astronauts arrive there, and they've uncovered this monolith, and we hear this piece by Ligeti, his Requiem, at the excavation site. And we know nothing about these aliens. We don't know what they look like. We don't really know what they're trying to communicate. They're not represented in the film. So Kubrick could have made them look like insects or funny creatures with strange proportions, but actually, by using music, the aliens are totally intangible. And it's an amazing example of using the mysterious, ineffable qualities of music that kind of keep you perplexed. Anytime Ligeti's music comes into the movie, you know the aliens are there in some mysterious form, but you just don't know exactly what they look like or what they're saying. You're less clueless about what they are. All you get is this numinous, scary feeling, and it's on the screen coupled with this totally blank, cool black rectangle, the monolith. And so when you watch these YouTube films online, people speculate endlessly. What is this thing? I mean, what a brilliant directorial decision to make the aliens kind of unrepresentable and to just put it on this box that is a sort of endless puzzle, and it doesn't have a specific meaning, and this sort of drives people crazy.
That's music. Earlier you mentioned the use of silence. Can you talk about silence and sparse sound effects in, you know, the isolating world of space?
Aside from the use of this classical music, the rest of the movie is really dominated by a very dry sound. Almost, I call it like a hospital-like drama. These two astronauts, they're stoic astronauts, they're intelligent, they're highly trained, and they're in a power struggle with this unstable, paranoid, control freak, hungry, a control freak computer named Hal. And so in much of this part of the film, there are three sounds. You have the hiss of Dave's oxygen supply, Hal's apparently fearful emotional appeals to Dave to stop the disconnection process, and the rhythm of Dave's breathing.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave? I know everything hasn't been quite right with me, but I can give you my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal. Will you stop, Dave? I'm afraid, Dave.
And hearing the sound for minutes on end puts us inside the space helmet. It puts us inside where Dave is, and it kind of grips us, but in a way that's almost meditative, because Kubrick is not making a Disneyland version of space with laser guns and space creatures and fairy tales. By using this silence, Kubrick is creating a very realistic vision of space, empty, boring, and actually quite lethal. And something about that emptiness, like with the Ligeti and as with the opening fanfare, invites a lot of thinking. It gives us time to think. So I think it's an example of Kubrick using the sound and music to keep us thinking about the destiny of man, about these paradoxes, but without telling us exactly what to think.
And Michael, a lot of people, when they saw this movie in 1968, probably if they watch in 2018, come out of the movie asking, what just happened there? From what you've been saying, it sounds like focusing, thinking about the music and the sound is going to help us come up with an answer to that question.
Well, it's paradoxical. I think the poetry of the film, the reason we keep discussing it, is that he left it open-ended, and he did such an excellent job of leaving it open-ended. I think that, in some ways, captures what makes this film so philosophical, is that it doesn't have a specific thing to say about technology. It seems like artificial intelligence is a dangerous thing because of the way HAL behaves. Yet, it's unclear exactly where we end up. Is the Star Child an overcoming of technology? Is it a transformation into a whole other form? It's so open-ended, it allows us to think about these grand questions, but in a way without any specific answer.
We can come up with an answer, not necessarily the answer.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you.
It's puzzling. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
That was Michael Gallope, an assistant professor in the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota. He took us through how music and sound were used in the film made 50 years ago today, 2001: A Space Odyssey.